Today at Reader's Corner, Bruce Riedel, author of Deadly Embrace, Pakistan, America, and the Future of the Global Jihad.
U.S.-Pakistan relationship has been troubled almost from the start, and for a variety of reasons, usually involving one or another secret project. If we ever can put the issue of terrorism and the Afghanistan war behind us, this issue of nuclear weapons would be at the top of our agenda with Pakistan. Both Democrats and Republicans, always for a good short-term reason, have supported Pakistan's military dictators. The result of that is that we've contributed to the weakness of civilian democratic government in Pakistan.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The relationship between Pakistan and America is a complicated one, meandering through periods of friendship and enmity, symbiosis and distrust. It's no wonder that people in both nations are confused. In his latest book, Deadly Embrace, Pakistan, America, and the Future of the Global Jihad, Bruce Riedel explains how and why the history of Pakistan-U.S. relations has unfolded as it has. He outlines what our nation can do to repair the damage and how we can avoid making similar mistakes in dealing with extremist forces in Pakistan and beyond. Deadly Embrace is now available in paperback. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Bruce Riedel. He is one of America's foremost authorities on U.S. security and a senior fellow at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. A former CIA officer, he was a senior advisor to four U.S. presidents on Middle East and South Asian issues. Mr. Riedel was a guest on Reader's Corner in 2009 to discuss his book, The Search for Al-Qaeda. He joined us by phone for this interview. Bruce Riedel, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me back. It's a pleasure.
Well, I guess we can begin with the, I guess I'd call it a nightmare if I was a publisher or an author to do this book. And then no more than a few weeks or however long it was after it's out, you have this incredible development in Pakistan with Obama directing the order to kill on bin Laden, and the entire effort is successful. Was there a moment when you wondered, gee, if we only had waited a few weeks for that book to come out?
Well, you know, in the business of writing about relatively current affairs, there's never a perfect moment to write. But I think that what we discovered about bin Laden hiding in the heartland of the Pakistani National Security Establishment, less than a mile from Pakistan's equivalent of West Point or the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, surrounded by Pakistani military checkpoints, only underscored really the main point of the book, which is that Pakistan is a very difficult ally at best, duplicitous in the worst of times, and a country filled with contradictions that are very hard for outsiders to fully grasp.
Now, obviously, the reason why we should all be concerned about Pakistan is the fact that it's known for its state-sponsored terrorism. But even if that didn't exist, it's a nuclear power. And it's been responsible for spreading nuclear technology to unstable regimes. I think you mentioned A.Q. Khan in your book, who I believe is still under house arrest, whatever that means in Pakistan today. But could you help us a bit with just how much of a threat this is to the international order as we know it, especially as it applies to this continuing struggle between India and Pakistan?
Pakistan is best known in America today as a patron state sponsor of terrorism. It supports the Afghan Taliban, which are fighting our troops in Afghanistan every day, and it has shadowy links to a host of other groups. But even if we didn't have a problem with terrorism with Pakistan, we would have a fundamental problem with its nuclear ambitions. Driven by its rivalry with India, which remains the number one priority of Pakistan's generals and nuclear scientists, Pakistan is on a course to become the third or fourth largest nuclear weapons state in the world. It's already surpassed the United Kingdom as the fifth largest nuclear power, and it's in the process of surpassing France, and it may even surpass China. That means it'll have an arsenal of several hundred nuclear weapons. Pakistan now is also starting to develop tactical nuclear weapons, the kind that you could use on a battlefield, which raises significant questions about command and control of these weapons in the future. President Obama has committed the United States to trying to denuclearize the world and to cutting back on the size of the American and Russian nuclear weapons arsenals. We're engaged in a very difficult effort now to persuade Iran not to cross the nuclear weapons threshold. And yet Pakistan stands outside all of the international arms control regimes. It's never signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's never signed the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. And it's the single biggest obstacle to an international agreement on stopping the development of more high fissionable material. This issue of nuclear weapons, if we ever can put the issue of terrorism and the Afghanistan war behind us, this issue of nuclear weapons would be at the top of our agenda with Pakistan, as it has sometimes in the past, particularly when AQ Khan was operating his international proliferation networks. AQ Khan, we now know, is responsible for starting the Iranian centrifuge program. He sold Libya an entire erector set of nuclear weapons, and he was deeply involved with the North Korean nuclear program as well. So it's a considerable and very important problem as the United States thinks about Pakistan.
Has the United States, through its support of the military in Pakistan, played a role in this development? It seems as though we have this very confusing policy, which you point out in your book, of where one day we're in favor of civilian rule and we're talking about democracy in Pakistan, but the next day we're hanging in there with Musharraf, for example, as we did for years during the Bush administration.
The U.S.-Pakistan relationship has been troubled almost from the start. And for a variety of reasons, usually involving one or another secret project, the United States over the last 60 years has backed every Pakistani military dictator. We're good at saying we support democracy in Pakistan, but in practice, we've been in love with every general in uniform once they took over Pakistan. This is also a remarkably bipartisan thing. Democratic presidents and Republican presidents have done the same. Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan both supported Zia-ul-Haq in the 1980s in order to support the war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. John F. Kennedy invited Pakistan's first military dictator, Ayub Khan, to a state dinner at Mount Vernon, the home of George Washington. Eisenhower may have played a role in the coup that brought Ayub Khan to power in 1958. So both Democrats and Republicans, always for a good short-term reason, have supported Pakistan's military dictators. The result of that is that we've contributed to the weakness of civilian democratic government in Pakistan. It's not all our fault. Pakistanis have to bear the burden of blame for this, but we've contributed to it. It's also meant that Pakistanis have come to see us as very fickle allies. We support a dictator for a while. We get tired of him. We provide Pakistan some years with huge amounts of military equipment, and then other years we sanction Pakistan. Again, the particulars in each case are important, but the overall pattern has convinced Pakistanis that America's just not a reliable ally. Consequently, today, America has extremely low approval ratings in Pakistan, probably among the lowest of any country in the world. America is more unpopular in Pakistan than India. And any time you outpoll India as the bad guy in Pakistan, you're in a deep, deep hole.
You're listening to Bruce Riedel. He's talking about his new book, Deadly Embrace. Well, let's look at the Pakistani-American relationship through Pakistani eyes, if we could. And I guess you just said it, but I want to make sure that we've covered what it is about that policy or set of policies over the years that gives Pakistani critics the right to claim that the United States hasn't exactly been fair and accurate with them either?
Well, I think you're right. From our standpoint, Pakistanis appear to be duplicitous and playing both sides of the fence. When we found Osama bin Laden's hideout in Abbottabad last May, for example, it immediately raised the question, who in Pakistan knew about this? Did the Pakistani army know? Did the Pakistani intelligence service know? Newt Gingrich, in one of the debates, said to him it was inconceivable that the Pakistani army didn't know. And Newt Gingrich is not the only person who's raised that point. So from our perspective, they look duplicitous. They look like they're double-dealing us. From the Pakistani standpoint, the United States came into their country in the dark of night without permission and carried out a counterterrorist mission on their soil, killing Mr. bin Laden. From their standpoint, that was a violation of their sovereignty. Their country felt humiliated when it was all over. Don't get me wrong. I think President Obama did exactly the right thing in May 2011, and I think he deserves a tremendous amount of credit for a bold and courageous decision. But when you try to look at it from the Pakistani standpoint, it looks like a violation of their sovereignty and a humiliation of their army. And this comes after years now of drone operations against al-Qaeda targets in Pakistan. Again, I think those drone operations have been very successful from our standpoint in putting pressure on al-Qaeda. From the Pakistani standpoint, it's another country carrying out secret targeted killing on their soil, something they find to be humiliating and to be a violation of their territorial integrity.
Let's break down this decision of the president to go after bin Laden on that particular night. It seems there's two aspects to it. First of all, his decision not to share with the Pakistanis what we knew and what we were about to do. And then secondly, the decision to order the kill. The decision to order the kill, you've worked in the company of presidents. I find it hard to believe that knowing what we knew, the decision to order the kill would have been that different across previous administrations. Is that right or not? We'll never know, of course, but that seems to be the easy part, if you will, and I don't mean to be flippant about it.
I think that's right. I think almost any president would have said, look, if you can capture him with no risk, fine, but don't go in there as that with your primary purpose. And I also think that bin Laden had no intention of being captured, and the people around him, including his family members, had no intention of letting this man be captured. He had no intention of spending the rest of his life in an American jail of any kind. I think the president's decision to go forward with the raid is a very bold and brave one. There were high risks involved here. First of all, by the accounts of Leon Panetta and others who were involved, there was only a 50-50 certainty that bin Laden was there. Probably not going to get better than that, but that's still, you know, 50-50 is a tough thing to make a decision on the basis of. Secondly, we didn't know what the Pakistanis might do. Might the Pakistanis have fought back? Could those helicopters been intercepted by Pakistani fighters on their way in or outside of the country, either because they didn't know who we were or because they were in cahoots with hiding bin Laden? And then there are always the things that go wrong, and things did go wrong. One of the helicopters had a very hard landing and had to be destroyed, and you had to bring in another helicopter. It takes, I think, a fair amount of resolve to order people into combat in any case. This is the toughest decision any president has to make. And sending them on a mission deep inside another country in the dark of night, that's a bold and courageous decision. and I think the president deserves a lot of credit for it. I think he was also right not to tell the Pakistanis in advance. I think it's virtually certain that had we shared the information we had about bin Laden's hideout with the Pakistanis, he wouldn't have been there when we came looking for him.
And I guess that's what I was getting at. First of all, I agree entirely with you on the decision the president made. But getting back to the decision not to share, given past administrations' coziness with President or General Musharraf, whatever you want to call him, the military, you just wonder if, in fact, Obama didn't do something even more precedent-breaking in this regard by not sharing. Again, you're much more privy to the relationships between these two countries than any of us could be. But seems to me that it would have been very tempting to share that with somebody who we thought we could trust over there.
Well, in the strategic review that President Obama asked me to chair in the first months of 2009, one of our key conclusions was that Pakistan was not a reliable and trustworthy ally. That doesn't mean you don't deal with them. We have to deal with them. Pakistan is a big country. We got a lot of issues. We've talked about those, terrorism, nuclear, and others. We have to deal with Pakistan. We have to engage. But one of the key conclusions of the review that President asked me to chair was that we had been misled in the past by Pakistan on very sensitive terrorism-related issues, and that we needed to be very, very careful in what information we shared with them. And that, in particular, the Musharraf government had played a double game with us. You know, we now know that Osama bin Laden moved into that safe house sometime in late 2005, early 2006. That was the height of Musharraf's period in office. Musharraf can't now simply claim he's out of office, he had no idea what was going on. This happened on his watch, and it raises very, very fundamental questions about what did the Musharraf government know about Osama bin Laden's presence in this safe haven, again, just less than a mile from the outside of Pakistan's National Military Academy.
One of the reasons to buy your paperback version of this book is to get a chance to read the new preface, The Mystery of Abbottabad, which you wrote after the killing of bin Laden, and you have some insights into what happened that you couldn't possibly have in the original edition of the book. And at the end, you talk about engaging Pakistan. I sense a bit of a subtle shift, and maybe it's just me, that you've started to use the word containment more than engagement. And as a matter of fact, even when you're talking about engaging Pakistan in the hardcover version, you talk about drawing red lines and holding Pakistan accountable. Do they get that today? Do they understand that the United States is, from here on out, going to draw red lines and that we are going to hold them accountable?
U.S.-Pakistan relations are now in the worst shape they've been really since September 11th, 2001. The deadly embrace of American-Pakistan relations that's troubled us for 60 years, I think, passed a milestone in May of 2011 when we found Osama bin Laden. As I said, from our standpoint, it raises important questions about Pakistan's complicity in hiding him. From the Pakistani standpoint, it raised questions about American violation of their sovereignty. And ever since that evening, this relationship has gone down further. From the beginning, I felt that we have to have a very nuanced policy with Pakistan, which mixes engagement with some tough red lines and some elements of containment. And I think post-Abbottabad, that's even more the case. We can't ignore Pakistan. It's too important. We do have a lot to talk about. But on the other hand, I think we need to be clear with Pakistan, and particularly with its military, that the most egregious examples of its support for terrorism, nuclear proliferation, are red lines for us, and there's going to be consequences if they pursue those kinds of policies. The challenge, though, is this. There are people in Pakistan who want a more democratic, a more progressive country, Benazir Bhutto, for example, the murdered former prime minister of the country, had a vision of Pakistan which is much more consistent with what I think we would like to see there. So we have to, at the one hand, contain the excesses of the anti-American generals, and on the other, encourage the pursuit of a more democratic civilian government by progressive elements in Pakistan. That's a difficult act to perform. It's a nuanced policy. It's not reducible to a black and white formula. It means we have to pursue occasionally contradictory parts of one policy at the same time. But that's the nature of the game we're dealing with here. We're dealing with a very complex, very gray problem, Pakistan, and we need to pursue an equally complex and nuanced strategy to try to nudge Pakistan in the long term into a more positive kind of policy on all of these issues, from terrorism to nuclear proliferation to its relationship with India.
You're listening to Bruce Riedel. He's the author of Deadly Embrace. Let's follow that up, Bruce, for a moment. In your book, I believe in the preface, there's a discussion, and there's a discussion in many of the articles since the May 11th event that questions, well, who knew about this over in Pakistan? Did the president know about it? And I think you and others say, probably not. And if that's good news, then the bad news is the reason he didn't know about it is that he's pretty much of a puppet regime. And it's not a good sign for civilian control of the country and for a real democratic process. So it just seems like a catch-22 here where, yeah, not everybody did know where bin Laden was living, but they should have. And if there was a real civilian government, perhaps they would have. And the guy I'm talking about, Zardari, if that's the way to pronounce his name, is the husband of Benazir Bhutto, who, as you say, was assassinated. And he's now the president. What is the hope for a democratic Pakistan at this time?
Well, the Zardari government, President Zardari, almost certainly was clueless about the hideout in Abbottabad, and that's because the civilian government has very little control over the military and the ISI. What we're seeing going on in Pakistan today is a profound and deep struggle between what I'll call progressive forces in the country, civilian politicians, many entrepreneurs, parts of the judiciary, the media, trying to put Pakistan on a course towards what it was originally intended to be. Pakistan was founded in 1947 with a vision of being a democratic, prosperous country at peace with itself and at peace with its neighbors. It's gotten off course. Four military dictators have taken it very far off course. But I think I want to stress to people who are following Pakistan that there are people there who are fighting very hard at great risk to their own lives for a different kind of Pakistan. These people are literally dying in the pursuit of trying to make Pakistan a more normal country. Just last year, the governor of Punjab, one of the most progressive politicians in the country, was assassinated by jihadist elements. The minister of state for minority affairs was assassinated. There is hope here in Pakistan. It is not a hopeless situation. These people need our support. They certainly need our encouragement because they're trying to move Pakistan in the direction we want them to go. And this battle for the soul of Pakistan is a battle that really matters for Americans in the long term. If this country is going to have the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world, as it probably will, we want that arsenal to be in the hands of responsible, democratically elected civilian government, not in the hands of some anti-American fanatic general who wants to use it to support terrorism and the global jihad.
How do the current conditions in Pakistan affect our policy in Afghanistan and the ability of Afghanistan to get on its feet and, of course, most importantly from our standpoint, for the U.S. to get out?
Well, in many ways, the United States and Pakistan are at war with each other now in Afghanistan. We don't say that. They don't say that. But Pakistan is the principal supporter of the Afghan Taliban. Just last week, a NATO study of interrogation of 4,000 Taliban prisoners was leaked. And according to the leaks, those prisoners all said the same thing. Pakistan is our sponsor. Our headquarters is in Pakistan. That's where our safe havens and sanctuaries are. That's not new news, but this new NATO study is a very authoritative statement of the reality. That said, Pakistan's support for the Afghan Taliban makes it much more difficult to accomplish our objectives in Afghanistan. We've tried now for the last 3 years to see if we can't persuade Pakistan to bring the Taliban to the negotiating table. We have some hints that that may be possible in the foreseeable future, but they're hints at this stage, not certitudes by any means. It's another reason why, despite our fundamental differences with Pakistan, engagement has to go on as we try to explore if there are ways we can find a mutual basis for cooperation. Even if we're skeptical those ways are there, we've got to at least explore them.
Well, when I hear you say that we're at war with Pakistan and Afghanistan, and I'm thinking of the current state of our U.S. Congress and how volatile and they can become just on any one issue, it certainly sounds like diplomacy could get pushed to the side in the U.S. Congress on this issue. And you might tell us a little bit about how the Pressler Amendment did that for a number of years. That's behind us now, I guess. But still, it makes one wonder how diplomacy can survive when you have a country at war with the United States in the country we're trying to assist, namely Afghanistan.
Well, I certainly don't envy Secretary Clinton having to go up and explain the nuances of Pakistan policy to the Congress of the United States. I've been there, and just as you say, shades of gray don't usually sell well on Capitol Hill. And that's particularly true, of course, in an election year. Election years are not usually the time when American politics are most susceptible to subtlety and nuance. And I wouldn't be surprised if this becomes more of a political issue as we get closer to November. But I think the good news is, and I do spend a fair amount of time on Capitol Hill talking to both sides of the aisle about Pakistan, and what I discover up there is a great deal of interest, an understanding that this is important. Both among Republicans and Democrats, when you talk to them in private, away from the TV camera, many of them get it, that this is hard, and this isn't going to be done easily, and it's not going to be done with a slogan. It's going to require hard, slogging work, both engaging and containing Pakistan at the same time. So I think I would hope that listeners would get some satisfaction in knowing that when you get congressmen and senators away from the bright lights into a more quiet environment, they usually are much more understanding of the subtleties and the nuances of foreign policy than they may sound when they're on the campaign trail.
That's right, and we are at the moment immersed in campaign political news, and that probably distorts the way things look to us at the moment. Bruce, thanks so much for joining us today on Reader's Corner. Really appreciated your book. Again, it's Deadly Embrace, Pakistan, America, and the Future of the Global Jihad.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Bruce Riedel. Next week, Eliza Griswold, author of The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.